So is it a culture where conflicts are avoided, or where hierarchy solves conflicts because always hierarchy is right and the people have to accept that? Or is it a culture where conflicts are seen as a creative source, a source of creativity, of discussion, different viewpoints, and people like to kind of having dialogues about the best possible perspective? And all that together, often unseen, is what social dynamics are about. And leadership now, modern leadership has to understand and to know about the social dynamics and all this unconscious bias in groups if you really want to become successful.
Welcome to another episode of the Major Outcomes Podcast. Actually, the final episode of this season before the summer break. And I am really excited to have Sebastian Morgner today as a guest. Sebastian was one of the most popular contributors at our previous Outcome Economy Summit of WorkPath. We will definitely put links to his presentation and the great workshop he gave there into the show notes. And we get so much good feedback on the topics that Sebastian talked about during the Outcome Economy Summit, about leadership dynamics and strategic planning and collaboration in combination with looking at the leadership team, the social dynamics and the neurosocial aspects in teams. That's something we're going to dive a bit deeper in based on all of your feedback. Sebastian is managing director of the MLI Leadership Institute in Munich. He advises teams, mainly leadership teams of global companies, on various topics around digital transformation and strategy implementation. So he not just consults, he also actively coaches executives and companies. And in many ways, and that's another connect we have with WorkPath and Sebastian Morgner's work, he works with OKRs and outcome-oriented frameworks to develop strategy and implement strategy together with his customers. Sebastian is also an author. He wrote the book Expedition Future, How You Can Use Chance to Master Uncertainty and Complexity. And I think in many ways you can see him as a pioneer in digitization topics. He's also a certified mental coach and a keynote speaker. He is married, father to three daughters, and co-founder of the Future of Leadership Initiative. So a lot of things. Again, we'll put some of these details into the show notes. Sebastian, thank you for being here. It's great to have you. Did I forget anything?
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here with you. I think the only thing you forgot is that I'm a proud dog owner since Corona. I have a dog and he's also the second male in our tribe, Fritz. And he joins me to all the things that my ladies don't like going to the nature, doing a mountain bike or going for a hike. So. That's important for my life, perhaps not so much for OKRs, but for myself.
Amazing. To complete the family picture, yeah. You've obviously are doing a lot and you've been doing a lot. So do you want to just give our audience a few more details on your background? Like, how did you get to where you are today? And if I suggested we go into like neuro leadership, neuro social dynamics in leadership teams, maybe you can give us an idea of what got you to that topic.
Yeah, actually, I mean, I was in the management of the financial industry for 15 years after finishing my university degree. And, really by chance, I had no idea about it, actually, I have to say. I got into a position where I was responsible for the internet business of an investment firm. I had this, or we had this strange idea, I think 24 years ago, to provide a co-branded portal where you could buy investment funds. And I mean, actually, I presented it just, I think, 2 weeks before Christmas, just as a gag, you know, so it was a fake PowerPoint prototype. And the management was so excited that I went out of this meeting and I had, I think, 15 million budget and 40 people to do something. Mm-hmm. And actually, I mean, this was in the times of the first internet hype, as the way it really started, no? Yeah, and then I had several positions, always about kind of transformation or pioneering things like digital transformation in the banking industry. Actually, my big vision was to help creating a bank that is really customer-centric and, you know, that advises customers around their life goals. So also as kind of a coaching approach. And so I was very much in strategic projects, and for me it was really interesting observing certain patterns after a while, which I was a little bit confused about. So one pattern was that often when there was an idea, a lot of effort was put in doing nice PowerPoint presentations and, you know, somehow influencing a decision in the group board for a certain strategy. Often it was kind of linked to reorganizations, and the one who had proposed the strategy often was able to increase his area of influence. And then I observed that, you know, more or less when a strategy was decided, the implementation was neglected. For me, it was unbelievable, you know. So it was decided, the person was in a new position. And then when I thought, now the work is starting, actually not so much happened, at least not what I expected. And I started to have it as a hobby then that I looked, where was a business case, what was a strategy decided, and half a year later I was asking the people that should have been the responsibles for execution, so that were needed that this strategy comes to life. And I observed that, you know, what they knew about the strategy and what they had changed was more or less nothing in many, many cases. And so I said, okay, there is room for improvement. And I started having a big, big interest in what does it need to, when you have a vision, an idea, yeah, to somehow integrate others, that you need to find followers for that and to align thinking and action towards this common goal. And
so this is sort of like, I think the way you describe it, it really sounds like a very natural journey of like one step that led to the other based on your own practitioner's experience as an operator or in a financial institution. I think the first time we met a couple of years ago, that already was what stuck out where we connected on, right? It's like strategy, implementation, and that shared conviction that a lot of companies do have solid strategies, but the way they are communicated, the way they are like, what happens exactly as you just phrased it, what happens once you have it, how do you get it into motion? I think that's something that I recognized you for in the first couple of touch points. So I'm curious over time, and because we want to focus on social dynamics, neurosocial dynamics, like how did you in the last 2 or 3 years maybe, how did you get closer to those kind of topics as one particular element of successful strategy implementation and your work with companies?
Yeah, actually, you know that we founded, I think 10 years ago, the Future of Leadership Initiative. So within the last 10 years, I really had the opportunity to talk to about 500 senior executives and also leadership experts on the topic, how to make a strategy really successful and become reality. And more and more we figured out that it's not so much the content that counts, but that it's really unconscious social dynamics that make the difference between failure or achievement, actually. Yeah? And I think this is really very counterintuitive or very much neglected in even today's leadership and business world, that so much is put into content, PowerPoints, Excel sheets. Yeah. But in the end, it's archaic behavioral patterns that very much drive if a company, if a team is really, moving towards one common goal or not. And I was very happy to find a study of McKinsey, Strategy Beyond the Hockey Stick, I think 3 years ago, where even the quants from McKinsey, which normally are known for number crunching and fact and figures, and they compared companies that were outperforming the profitability of the industry average, and they were analyzing, okay, what is kind of the lever, the reason why they in the long run are more successful than others. And they came to the conclusion that 80% of a company's performance can be explained by social dynamics. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you then dive deeper, and then you figure out that, we are living in a time where we have a lot of tools, very good tools like OKRs, agile tools. But if they are used in the wrong manner or with the wrong mindset, then they will not change a lot. And so what is social dynamics and neural social leadership for us is a leadership that uses social dynamics to achieve business performance, to achieve common goals. And this is really how, for example, power is distributed within a group or a company. So is there one decision maker, one bottleneck, or are decisions made in certain levels, and distributed around the team, the companies? Are there clear roles that have a decision-making power for certain topics? Then also it's the way how a group interacts with each other. So is there true collaboration? So come people together, open in mind, searching for a common solution, for a best possible solution, or is there a culture where people come and it's about who has right, who has the best idea, and it's not this typical not invented here syndrome. So people don't like it if others have a good idea. Then it's about handling conflicts. So is it a culture where conflicts are avoided, or where, hierarchy solves conflicts because always hierarchy is right and the people have to accept that? Or is it a culture where conflicts are seen as a creative source, a source of creativity, of discussion, different viewpoints, and people like to kind of having dialogues about the best possible perspective? And all that together, often unseen, is what social dynamics are about. And leadership now, modern leadership, has to understand and to know about the social dynamics and all this unconscious bias in groups if you really want to become successful.
It sounds like, if I've been following your work for some time, and I think successful leadership and strategic leadership, strategy implementation in more like complex or more difficult environments is something you've been talking about and working on for like a very long time, right? How do we behave? How do we have to behave in more volatile, more uncertain, more complex and ambiguous market environments? Everything you say, like these psychological and social patterns you mentioned as examples, sounds like those are more relevant and more under pressure or more like visible and present than ever with all the crisis we have, supply chain crisis, energy crisis, war, like all of those things happening right now. So do you also feel like these topics got more present the last couple of months and years, or what do you observe there?
We have a tool we call neuro lights or neuro traffic lights, and we analyze how people perceive their environment impacts their mental and physical performance or health. Mm-hmm. You know, because we think when people come together in nowadays business world, they have to be very open and they have to be in a good state, you know, to handle complexity. Because if you are stressed, your mind narrows, you are more aggressive, you feel more like a victim and so on. And this is not good for companies where the value creation in our times is very much about creativity and cognitive value add that or competence value add that a company has to deliver. Yeah, so we are a lot of value creation nowadays is creativity and mental work, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem of our time is the pure information overload that people are faced with, and the problem that people have to learn how to manage these kind of information. And so I think many people have a lot of battles they are fighting in their heads, yeah, even though they are not relevant for them at all, or they cannot be influenced by them at all. So I very much like this tool of the circle of influence, where you say focus on the things that you can influence and really be careful about letting too much information in your head about things that you just cannot change, but that make you being concerned. Because then what happens in your mind is you feel like a victim, you feel like having things not under control, so being, you know, just forced in a certain direction that you cannot influence, and this activates the neurotransmitter of cortisol. So you have this feeling of a long-term struggle that will never end, and your whole body is going in the standby mode, because your body then thinks, okay, I have to keep my resources, because I do not know when this fight will end, you know. But I always say most of the fights are just pure brain fuck, as it's called sometimes. So mental fights, because people are reading too much newspapers, are in the internet, use their time instead they go in the wood and enjoy the beautiful nature, or together to friends. They go to YouTube and see strange theories about how the world works. And I think this is a big, big problem. Yeah, and this is also a problem for leadership, because leadership now competes with many other information sources that keep people mentally engaged. And in the end, when you want to form a team that achieves a result and that will really outperform, people have to stay focused on your common goal. They have to learn things that are relevant to get there. And, you know, and if in their spare time or even at work, they are too much in information that just makes them afraid, but that doesn't help them, they will not be successful. And so I think that's the problem of our time, that we have so much information at a fingertip that it's hard to guide people to avoid, you know, noise and to focus on the relevant things. And not only in the big environment, even in large companies, you know, I mean, you can, I know people that come there, they have a position, let's say, called head of innovation, and if you look at their schedule, 80% of the time they are in meetings which, you know, where they only passive actors listening to things that are not really relevant for them, and so they have no time at all to do the stuff they have been engaged for.
Oh, there. Thank you very much. I think there is a lot of things to unpack in there. On the one hand, it sounds like you work with a couple of tools and frameworks that we believe in at WorkPath and that I really like using, right? I think something you said in between, I said a couple of times the last couple of weeks and months, it's so easy to say and yet so hard to implement. It's like worrying has never changed the outcome, and it demands so much like self-leadership and, as you said, focus to really think about what can I influence and what do I have to maybe also sort of like neglect or not look at right now, even though it's very loud and even though it's very present. So that to some extent already builds a bridge towards then strategy execution and planning, right? I think a good planning process with a leadership team helps you providing that kind of focus on what are the most important outcomes we need to achieve. But then also when we work with customers, we work with this concept of sphere of influence. What can you actually have an impact on, and what is it worth maybe even actively zooming out and not looking at it? But before we get there, before we talk about the role of neurosocial leadership and being aware of those dynamics around power, interaction between different leaders, conflict behavior, what you do sounds like to be at the interface of obviously like frameworks and tools and processes that are very important for the company and that you could easily like define as processes, but at the interface from that to very, very personal dynamics. It sounds like it starts a lot with self-leadership and how individuals see and feel and treat themselves and then treat each other in a team. So can you mentioned a couple of tools you work with and concepts, but how do you work with teams? It sounds like it's not just consulting and then doing a couple of workshops, but really this must go into coaching, I imagine. Like how do you bring that to life? Or from the other perspective, if we are a new leadership team who's interested in what you're saying, but not so familiar with thinking about neurosocial dynamics in our team, how would you approach it with us?
Yeah, actually, I mean, even though I'm not so much a football enthusiast, I think it's a little bit like in a football team, you know? I mean, when you're a leadership team, you need to have people that understand each other and that share a joint vision. And this is very easily spoken, but it's not so easily realized, you know? Mm-hmm. Because they're... You know, diversity is key in nowadays environment. So you need a team that covers a lot of, you know, viewpoints on a certain topic. On the other side, it needs a base that people really understand each other. Yeah, I in the past had a partner in my business. We really liked each other, but we really talked in so different ways that we were not able to understand each other. So, for example, when I would have said we are in big shit, we are in deep shit, and a project is really, it's so terrifically in a bad shape, yeah. Then he would say, oh, everything is great, there are little challenges that we have to clarify with our customer. And so when you have very different communication patterns, and this very much is shaped by your personality, by your character, and by also your experiences, and you figure out that a team has a set of people that are not able to have an efficient or effective dialogue with each other, then for sure you have a dysfunctional team, and you have somehow have to solve it. So
is this where you start? You do like do personality tests, observing how they behave, and then are the mirror for this team, or how do you get started till teams get into
exactly
a productive mode about it?
Normally, when I get invited to coach a team, and you know, I understand myself as really a benevolent friend of a whole team, so I want mm-hmm. to do the best for the leadership team. I first have interviews with each team member, I ask each team member in a very, let's say, private setting, how this person sees the current situation, how this person sees the team itself, what this person thinks is the common goal they want to achieve, what this person thinks are the levers that are most important to get there, where this person sees the major obstacles. And then I bring together all the different viewpoints and I do something I call a heat map. So we visualize where we say, okay, this is where the team is very close together in how they understand the situation, how they evaluate the situation and the key success levers. And this is where perspectives are far away from each other, you know? And we even measure, so we have certain questions, you know, do you have the feeling that you have a common vision? Do you have complementary goals? Do you trust each other? So is there psychological safety? We have kind of eight factors that are scientifically proven show if a team is really a high-performing team. And then we ask them, how do you assess it? And we see there's a big spread, so one person says, everything is clear, we have a clear vision, and one person says, zero, we have no vision at all, then we know, okay, they have a big problem, even a bigger problem than if all of them would say, we have no vision, you know, because if they agree what the starting point is, it's better than if they have totally different viewpoints about the starting point. And so this is the first assessment, then I show this the team and then we discuss it. And then it's really a two-sided coaching process. So one is together with the team, thinking about the strategy, the priorities, aligning priorities and getting them into an OKR process for strategy implementation so that the management itself defines each quarter what are our priorities. But on the other hand, also coaching each individual in such a management team about their obstacles, their problems they have. And often it's communication and they feel not accepted by the others and so on.
Yeah.
It's very, very important to work on both levels. So on the team level and on the individual level, that the individual feels a respected and safe part of a strong team.
Let's focus on that for a moment, like on that step from working with the individuals to working with the team, and then what you just described as coming together for a joint prioritization and planning process from strategy to execution. So let's talk about outcome management, or like a very outcome-oriented way of strategy execution that you bring into teams with OKRs. And maybe we can pick a couple of examples, right? I always like to explain a framework like OKRs for strategic planning, goal setting, and then for the collaboration around these goals. I think it also always is a little bit of a analytical tool, because when people get into such a process, when they follow a certain framework with certain guiding questions and basically start breaking down their strategy and discuss that, as you just said, I think this tells you so much about the dynamics in the team and what works in the team and what doesn't. So it can really be a mirror, an analytical tool where you deduce a lot of learnings. And it's not just on, do we have shared goals? Do we achieve these goals? But really, how is the system around these goals actually behaving? So when we focus on OKRs and goal setting with OKRs, like, can you share a couple of typical examples from a neurosocial perspective where you see like teams coming together, they define outcomes, they define key results. What are typical dynamics you see going back to the patterns you mentioned earlier, right? Power dynamics, conflict dynamics. Like, can you share a couple of examples there maybe?
In the end, if you really look at the fundamental needs of people, also in the working context, but general in life, people need two things, you know. They need to have the feeling that they are part of a tribe, respected part of a tribe, so that they have a clear role and that they are valued about their contribution to this tribe. Yeah, I think this is deeply ingrained in our neuro system. And if they have the, if I have the feeling I'm part of a tribe, of a group, and I know why I'm here and the others see it, then the neurotransmitter serotonin is activated. So I really feel kind of relaxed when I'm in the group. I'm very open-minded. So I'm really in a different state then. I'm open, I'm aware how the others feel. I'm open to feedback because I feel safe in this environment. This is one thing that is very important. And the second thing is, and I always say our brain is like a GPS system, you know, so serotonin is, where am I right now? Do I feel comfortable and safe where I am right now? And then we need to have the feeling that we are on a good way, so that we have orientation, that we have a vision, that we have a bright future, that we know how to get there. And when you have the feeling, I understand the vision, I understand the goals, and I feel empowered and I feel the competence that I can get there, then dopamine is activated. So this is kind of the motivational neurotransmitter. And both feeling a good member of a strong team and having a clear vision and knowing about being able to contribute are the fundamental things that you have to be aware when you are in a leadership role, also when it's about target setting and OKRs. And what I, for example, observed in the past, if you have OKRs without a vision, then people still feel lost, you know? So I think a vision, for me, there's two very important things is, one is really having a tangible, inspiring vision in a company. And the second then is to have these regular spaces for target setting where you really have room to reflect and to discuss, are we on the right way? What's important right now? What are the obstacles right now? What have we learned in the last three quarters? So the most important things in the OKR process for me is having this time in a trusted team to discuss the situation. And this time, people otherwise do not invest. Yeah, if you really, I see so many managers that run from meeting to meeting, meet always the same people, but they do not come together in this setting and reflect, where do we stand right now? Is this really what is important? What is our purpose? And so on. So if you ask about social dynamics, for sure, if a company wants to implement OKRs, it only works if the foundation is there. So if you have a strong leadership team, if you have a leadership culture that empowers people, where psychological safety works, where responsibility is really distributed, where power is really distributed into teams, where the management is open to feedback. I have observed companies, you know, they thought, okay, it's just another tool. We buy a tool, then the manager, the CEO enters, this is my priorities, and now everybody else think about your priorities. There's no dialogue, there's no feedback. Everybody is entering some priorities they have. And that's it, you know, and then it becomes a bureaucratic process with no, perhaps it gives a little bit transparency, but it has no impact on the social dynamics, on the motivation, on the energy, on the, you know, inspiration of the people. So this is one thing I observe. Then I observe that we really good management teams, very open, very bottom-up, cooperative culture. They said, let's do OKRs, but they didn't have a clear vision. So they didn't know, they had no landscape to match the quarterly milestones on. And so each 3 months they came together And they always decided about different priorities, but you had the feeling that it's a boat, you know, that's sailing without a clear route in this direction and then in this direction. And from a neurosocial perspective, this also creates then, after a certain while, confusion and even panic in people's minds, because they think, okay, it's always so stressful. Each time we have a sprint and we try to realize something, it's very hard, but we do not see that we are on the right way. So in this case, I think it's so important that you then take the top management and the people, you know, the main thought leaders, and work on a challenging and but also motivating vision and a picture about what the company wants to look like in a moment when they have kind of achieved everything they want to achieve right now. And this gives a lot of safety then to the people. And then this helps people each quarter or whenever you do the target setting to check, are our priorities, you know, contributing to the long-term vision.
So you mentioned, I think, a couple of important points that strongly resonate with my experience, like starting with creating a space, creating the time and the room for leadership teams to have the right kind of discussions on that, and then working on a personal level to make sure there is psychological safety. There is this more or less safe space where leaders can discuss these priorities. You mentioned the vision, the purpose, like why are we doing all of this? I think that's really, besides the general management buy-in, still among the top three success criteria we experience again and again. If a company cannot say, and this is, I think, vision on two levels, right? If they cannot say, what kind of company do we want to become? Who are we in the future? But then also, why do we choose this new approach to goal setting? Why do we work with OKRs? Like it's always a more difficult path, and it oftentimes leads into nowhere, because people, it's difficult. It's going to be forth and back. It's going to be very iterative. A lot of things won't work in the beginning. So we need to be clear, as you, I think, mentioned, like we're moving towards the right direction, and there might be some setbacks, but there is progress. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Are there any other things leaders can do if you want to influence and develop your culture toward a more outcome-based mindset, outcome thinking? Are there any maybe social dynamics that you can influence to support that shift?
So I at least think that there are two more very important success levers if you want to implement an outcome culture. One tool that I think has a really high value if it's used right is the retrospective, so that you come together and regularly in the team, in the leadership team or in the team that is responsible for strategy execution, you discuss how do we work together, and what obstacles did we see in our cooperation and the way we work together. I really like in the agile world that kind of the content and the cooperation part is analyzed differently, because otherwise you have kind of a melting pot and it becomes very diffuse. And if a retrospective done right really helps to achieve something that is called psychological safety. So if you really listen to each other, if you really understand, okay, the way how I communicate that, for example, I'm a person that always starts with a strong statement which doesn't allow any, you know, other opinion, and that if you have a culture where people can say that, where they can share how they observe certain behavior patterns, and the other person accepts it and understands, okay, by this I destroy a lot of good ideas, because, for example, at the beginning I say it has to be like this, you know, or sometimes you have a behavior pattern or discussion pattern that somebody is listen listening until the end of a long, long discussion. And then at the end, this person, you know, is starting the bomb, bringing an argument that says, okay, all we have discussed that doesn't lead to the real result. And there you have to be aware about discussion and communication patterns that are dysfunctional and that disengage an open dialogue and an outcome-driven dialogue. This is, I think, one very important tool. And the second thing that you have to be very much aware of in a leadership position is that you do not create chaos about where are these decisions made and who is in control of what. So very often I observe that companies want to implement OKRs, and OKRs means you have one goal, you have a team around this goal. This team should come, should represent all the competences you need to achieve this goal from different areas, from different, even externals may be part of such a team. But then this team is autonomous and it should have the freedom to work against this goal. And when you then have line managers of certain people that say, hey, you have to report to me and you only can say that and do not disclose everything, and, you know, which then try to influence their people in a way of politics, of hiding information and so on, then it cannot work. And this is really where culture meets reality or ambition. Yeah. And where you have to be very aware and very precise. So you cannot, you should not look to the side and accept it if you see that there are behaviors that kind of are dysfunctional, because in the end they will ruin your strategy.
So it comes back to your first point, right? Having retrospectives and reflecting, seeing this whole process also as a mirror, as an analytical tool, where if you want certain principles and capabilities to be strengthened in your organization, like that outcome thinking and outcome mindset in your strategy and strategy execution, you have to look at it on a quarterly basis at least, like, are we actually getting there and where are we not there yet? Yeah. So I think that nicely closes to the loop to what you said earlier. I really like, and I think there is probably one or two previous episodes in this podcast that we could link here as well. I have to look, where we talked about the role of traditional org structures and if teams stick to them and if they sort of like insist on them, is like, this is our silo, this is our reporting line, and we keep things in transparent, that's almost always a bottleneck or a big hurdle for a real outcome-oriented organization, because outcome-based planning, outcome-based collaboration, outcome-based execution and success in the end towards outcomes, it's always a cross-functional, cross-team, interdisciplinary effort by definition, right? Particularly the more traditional functional org structures cannot allow that, and then you have to break that up, not necessarily changing your structures per se, but the way you communicate and the way you allow a dialogue. So I think that makes tons of sense. I already saw this coming, Sebastian. I mean, that topic is so big. Also during the Outcome Economy Summit, when you gave your talk, I think there were so many questions and discussion afterwards. We didn't really fit all of that in. And also today, I would love to continue, but we have to come to an end for today at least. Just one or two closing questions we'd like to ask all of our guests. And the first is, any kind of books or podcasts you would recommend, any kind of reading or inspirational sources on that topic or beyond that you would recommend to our audience if they want to dive deeper?
I mean, actually, for sure, I would recommend the book Expedition Zukunft. Yes. But only if you want to get a little bit more about our philosophy at the MLI. I mean, we really put all the insights of the Future of Leadership initiative that we collected there within 10 years. A book that very much inspired me is really Anti-Fragile from Nassim Taleb. So it's about what makes any kind of organism or organization not only robust, that you know in a crisis you don't break, but even more that you get strengthened out of a crisis. So what is the patterns and the mindsets that make you stronger by experiencing crisis? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The second book I very much like is Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow from Daniel Kahneman, because it's about all the biases that we as humans are faced with without even recognizing them when we do decision making, when we come together. It helps you really to become more aware about your behavior. And when you're once aware of a certain bias, then you have the chance to define for yourself strategies that help you overcome it. For example, using OKR. I mean, which really helps overcome, I think, a lot of biases.
Yeah, particularly in the context of today's topic of this episode here in the Major Outcomes podcast, that book is a real classic. I really like that one as well. Yeah. And then thank you very much again. We're going to put that into the show notes, of course. Last question, where can our listeners find more about you? How can they connect with you? How can they engage with you?
Actually, as you know, because you have been guest, I also host a podcast, the New Leadership Podcast, which can be found on Amazon and Spotify and the typical sources. You're more than welcome to, if you want to share your thoughts, either if you're in a leadership position and you have challenged certain transformations and certain topics, and you need a network of people that support you, because MLI is not just me, it's a network of about 100 experts and coaches, also very experienced former top leaders, that really help teams with the outside view, a systemic view from outside to be more effective in the transformation. Or if you are an expert and you would like to join the network, so go to www.leadership-munich.org to our website and contact me.
Perfect. We'll put a link to that into the show notes as well, for sure. So people will get right in front of you if they want to connect. Also, of course, to the podcast. Sebastian, thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Again, I really hope we can continue that conversation. It's something where we could talk hours, I'm sure. For today, I thank you very much for your time, and then hope to speak soon. Take care.
Thank you very much. I think I will go to have a bath in the lake now, because it's really hot today, isn't it?
It is.
Okay, Johannes.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thanks for tuning in today. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe to the Major Outcomes podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or any other major platform you might be using. Also, we'd be excited if you'd leave us a review. This helps us grow the community and spread the outcome mindset. See you on the next episode.